Stormfront by Jim Butcher. Print publication by Rock, a division of Penguin Putnam. This production is brought to you by Buzzy Multimedia Audiobooks and is read for you by James Marsters.
I heard the mailman approach my office door half an hour earlier than usual. He didn't sound right. His footsteps fell more heavily, jauntily, and he whistled. A new guy. He whistled his way to my front door, then fell silent for a moment. Then he laughed. Then he knocked. I winced. My mail comes through the mail slot unless it's registered. I get a really limited selection of registered mail, and it's never good news. I got up out of my office chair and opened the door. The new mailman, who looked like a basketball with arms and legs and a sunburned balding head, was chuckling at the sign on the glass door. He glanced at me and hooked a thumb toward the sign. "You're kidding, right?" I read the sign. People change it occasionally. And shook my head. "No, I'm serious. Can I have my mail, please?"
So, like parties, shows, stuff like that?
He looked past me as though he expected to see a white tiger, or possibly some skimpily clad assistants prancing around my one-room office. I sighed, not in the mood to get mocked again, and reached for the mail he held in his hand. "No, not like that. I don't do parties." He held on to it, his head tilted curiously.
"So what, some kind of fortune teller? Cards and crystal balls and things?"
"No," I told him, "I'm not a psychic." I tugged at the mail. He held on to it.
"What are you then?"
"What's the sign on the door say?"
"It says Harry Dresden, wizard."
"That's me," I confirmed.
"An actual wizard?"
he asked, grinning as though I should let him in on the joke.
"Spells and potions, demons and incantations, subtle and quick to anger?"
"Not so subtle." I jerked the mail out of his hand and looked pointedly at his clipboard. "Can I sign for my mail, please?" The new mailman's grin vanished and replaced with a scowl. He passed over the clipboard to let me sign for the mail, another late notice from my landlord, and said,
"You're a nut. That's what you are."
He took his clipboard back and said, "You have a nice day, sir." I watched him go. "Typical," I muttered, and shut the door. My name is Harry Blackstone Copperfield Dresden. Conjure it by your own risk. I'm a wizard. I work out of an office in Midtown Chicago. As far as I know, I'm the only openly practicing professional wizard in the country. You can find me in the Yellow Pages, under Wizards. Believe it or not, I'm the only one there. My ad looks like this. Harry Dresden, Wizard. Lost items found, paranormal investigations, consulting, advice, reasonable rates. No love potions, endless purses, parties, or other entertainment. You'd be surprised how many people call just to ask me if I'm serious. But then, if you'd seen the things I'd seen, if you knew half of what I knew, you'd wonder how anyone would not think I was serious. The end of the 20th century and the dawn of the new millennium had seen something of a renaissance in the public awareness of the paranormal. Psychics, haunts, vampires, you name it. People still didn't take them seriously, but all the things science had promised us hadn't come to pass. Disease was still a problem, starvation was still a problem, violence and crime and war were still problems. In spite of the advance of technology, things hadn't just changed the way everybody had hoped and thought they would. Science, the largest religion of the 20th century, had become somewhat tarnished by images of exploding space shuttles, crack babies, and a generation of complacent Americans who had allowed the television to raise their children. People were looking for something. I think they just didn't know what. And even though they were once again starting to open their eyes to the world of magic and the arcane that had been with them all the while, they still thought I must be some kind of joke. Anyway, it had been a slow month, a slow pair of months, actually. My rent from February didn't get paid until the 10th of March, and it was looking like it might be even longer until I got caught up for this month. My only job had been the previous week when I'd gone down to Branson, Missouri to investigate a country singer's possibly haunted house. It hadn't been. My client hadn't been happy with that answer, and had been even less happy when I suggested he lay off any intoxicating substances and try to get some exercise and sleep, and see if that didn't help things more than any exorcism. I'd gotten travel expenses plus an hour's pay, and gone away feeling I'd done my honest, righteous, and impractical thing.
I heard later he hired a shyster psychic to come in and perform a ceremony with a lot of incense and black lights. Some people. I finished up my paperback and tossed it into the dun box. There was a pile of red and discarded paperbacks in the cardboard box on one side of my desk. The spines bent and the pages mangled. I'm terribly hard on books. I was eyeing the pile of unread books, considering which to start next, given that I had no real work to do, when my phone rang. I stared at it in a somewhat surly fashion. We wizards are terrific at brooding. After the third ring, when I thought I wouldn't sound a little too eager, I picked up the receiver and said, "Dresden."
"Oh, is this some Harry Dresden, the, wizard?"
Her tone was apologetic, as though she were terribly afraid she would be insulting me. "No," I thought. "It's Harry Dresden, the, lizard. Harry Dresden, the wizard, is one door down." It is the prerogative of wizards to be grumpy. It is not, however, the prerogative of freelance consultants who are late on their rent, so instead of saying something smart, I told the woman on the phone, "Yes, ma'am, how can I help you today?"
She said, "I'm not sure. I've lost something, and I think maybe you could help me."
"Finding lost articles is a specialty," I said. "What would I be looking for?"
There was a nervous pause. "My husband," she said.
She had a voice that was a little hoarse, like a cheerleader who had been working on a long tournament, but had enough weight of years in it to place her as an adult. My eyebrows went up.
"Ma'am, I'm not really a missing persons specialist. Have you contacted the police or a private investigator?"
"No," she said quickly. "No, they can't. That is, I haven't." "Oh, dear, this is also complicated. Not something can talk about on the phone. I'm so sorry to take up your time, Mr. Dresden."
"Hold on now," I said quickly. "I'm sorry, you didn't tell me your name."
There was that nervous pause again, as though she was checking a sheet of written notes before answering.
"Call me Monica."
People who know diddly about wizards don't like to give us their names. They're convinced that if they give the wizard their name from their own lips, it could be used against them. To be fair, they're right. I had to be polite and harmless as I could. She was about to hang up out of pure indecision, and I needed the job. I could probably turn hubby up if I worked on it. "Okay, Monica," I told her, trying to sound as melodious and friendly as I could. "If you feel your situation is of a sensitive nature, maybe you could come by my office and talk about it. If it turns out that I can help you best, I will. And if not, then I can direct you to someone I think can help you better." I gritted my teeth and pretended I was smiling.
"No charge."
It must have been the no charge that did it. She agreed to come right out to the office and told me she would be there in an hour. That put her estimated arrival at about 2:30. Plenty of time to go out and get some lunch and then get back to the office to meet her. The phone rang again, almost the instant I put it down, making me jump. I peered at it. I don't trust electronics. Anything manufactured after the 40s is suspect. It doesn't seem to have much liking for me. You name it. Cars, radios, telephones, TV, VCRs. None of them seem to behave well for me. I don't even like to use automatic pencils. I answered the phone with the same false cheer I had summoned up for the Monica husband missing. "This is Dresden. May I help you?" "Harry, I need you at the Madison in the next 10 minutes. Can you be there?" The voice on the other end of the line was also a woman's. Cool, brisk, businesslike. "Why, Lieutenant Murphy," I gushed, overflowing with saccharin. "It's good to hear you, too. It's been so long." "Oh, they're fine, fine. And your family?" "Save it, Harry. I've got a couple of bodies here, and I need you to take a look around." I sobered immediately. Karen Murphy was the director of special investigations out of a downtown Chicago, a de facto appointee of the police commissioner to investigate any crimes dubbed unusual. Vampire attacks, troll maraudings, and fairy abductions of children didn't fit very neatly on a police report. But at the same time, people got attacked, infants got stolen, property was damaged or destroyed, and someone had to look into it. In Chicago, or pretty much anywhere in Chicagoland, that person was Karen Murphy. I was her library of the supernatural on legs, and a paid consultant for the police department. But two bodies? Two deaths by means unknown? I hadn't handled anything like that for her before. "Where are you?" I asked her. "Madison Hotel on 10th, 7th floor." "That's only a 15-minute walk from my office," I said. "So you could be here in 15 minutes, good." I said, I looked at the clock. Monica, no last name, would be here in little more than 45 minutes. "I've sort of got an appointment."
Dresden, I sort of got a pair of corpses with no leads and no suspects and a killer walking around loose. Your appointment can wait. My temper flared. It does that, actually. It can't, actually, I said, but I'll tell you what. I'll stroll on over and take a look around and be back here in time for it. Have you had lunch yet? She asked. What? She repeated the question. No, I said. Don't. There was a pause, and when she spoke again, there was sort of a greenish tone to her words. It's bad. How bad are we talking here, Murph? Her voice softened, and that scared me more than any images of gore or violent death could have. Murphy was the original tough girl. She prided herself on never showing weakness. It's bad, Harry. Please don't take too long. Special Crimes is itching to get their fingers on this one, and I know you don't like people to touch the scene before you can look around. I'm on the way, I told her, already standing and pulling my jacket on. Seventh floor, she reminded me. See you there. Okay. I turned off the lights to my office, went out the door, and locked up behind me, frowning. I wasn't sure how long it was going to take to investigate Murphy's scene, and I didn't want to miss out on speaking with Monica Ask Me No Questions. So I opened the door again, got out a piece of paper and thumbtack, and wrote, out briefly, back for appointment at 2:30, Dresden. That done, I started down the stairs. I rarely use the elevator, even though I'm on the fifth floor. Like I said, I don't trust machines. They're always breaking down on me just when I need them. Besides which, if I was someone in this town using magic to kill people two at a time, and I didn't want to get caught, I'd make sure that I removed the only practicing wizard the police department kept on retainer. I liked the odds on the stairwell a lot better than I did in the cramped confines of an elevator. Paranoid? Probably. But just because you're paranoid doesn't mean there isn't an invisible demon about to eat your face. Karen Murphy was waiting for me outside the Madison. Karen and I were a study in contrasts. Where I am tall and lean, she's short and stocky. Where I have dark hair and dark eyes, she's got Shirley Temple blonde locks and baby blues. Where my features are all lean and angular, with a hawkish nose and a sharp chin, hers are round and smooth, with a kind of cute nose you'd expect on a cheerleader. It was cool and windy, like it usually is in March, and she wore a long coat that covered her pantsuit. Murphy never wore dresses, though I suspected she'd have muscular, well-shaped legs, like a gymnast. She was built for function, and had a pair of trophies in her office from Aikido tournaments to prove it. Her hair was cut at shoulder length and whipped out wildly in the spring wind. She wasn't wearing earrings, and her makeup was of sufficient quality and quantity that it was tough to tell she had any on at all. She looked more like a favorite aunt or a cheerful mother than a hard-bitten homicide detective. "Don't you have any other jackets, Dresden?" she asked as I came within hailing distance. There were several police cars parked illegally in the front of the building. She glanced at my eyes for half a second and then away quickly. I had to give her credit. It was more than most people did. It wasn't really dangerous unless you did it for several seconds, but I was used to anyone who knew I was a wizard making it a point not to glance at my face. I looked down at my black canvas duster, with its heavy manteling and waterproof lining and sleeves actually long enough for my arms. What's wrong with this one? It belongs on the set of El Dorado. And? She snorted, an indelicate sound from so small a woman, and spun on her heel to walk towards the hotel's front doors. I caught up and walked a little ahead of her. She sped her pace, so did I. We raced one another towards the front door with increasing speed through the puddles left over from last night's rain. My legs were longer. I got there first. I opened the door for her and gallantly gestured for her to go in. It was an old contest of ours. Maybe my values are outdated, but I come from an old school of thought. I think that men ought to treat women like something other than just shorter, weaker men with breasts. Try to convict me as if I'm a bad person for thinking so. I enjoy treating a woman like a lady, opening doors for her, paying for shared meals, giving flowers, all that sort of thing. It irritates the hell out of Murphy, who had to fight and claw and play dirty with the hairiest men in Chicago to get as far as she has. She glared up at me as I stood there holding open the door, but there was a reassurance about the glare, a relaxation. She took an odd sort of comfort in our ritual, annoying as she usually found it. How bad was it up on the seventh floor, anyway? We rode up in the elevator in a sudden silence. We knew one another well enough by this time that the silences were not uncomfortable. I had a good sense of Murphy, an instinctual grasp for her moods and patterns of thought, something I develop whenever I'm around someone for any length of time. Whether it's a natural talent or a supernatural one, I don't know. My instincts told me that Murphy was tense, stretched as tight as piano wire. She kept it off her face, but there was something about the set of her shoulders and neck, the stiffness of her back that made me aware of it, or maybe I was just projecting it onto her. The confines of the elevator made me a bit nervous. I licked my lips and looked around the interior of the car. My shadow and Murphy's fell on the floor and almost looked as though we were sprawled there. There was something about it that bothered me, a nagging little instinct that I blew off as a case of nerves. "Steady, Harry." She let out a harsh breath just as the elevator slowed, then sucked in another one before the elevators opened, as though she was planning to hold it for as long as we were on the floor and breathing only when she got back into the elevator again. Blood smells a certain way, a kind of sticky, almost metallic odor, and the air was full of it when the elevator doors opened. My stomach quailed a little bit, but I swallowed manfully and followed Murphy out of the elevator and down the hall past a couple of uniformed cops who recognized me and waved me past without asking to see the little laminated card the city had given me. Granted, even in a big city department like Chicago PD, they didn't exactly call in a horde of consultants. I went down in the paperwork just as a psychic consultant, I think. But still, unprofessional of the boys in blue. Murphy preceded me into the room. The smell of blood grew thicker, but there wasn't anything gruesome behind door number one. The outer door of the suite looked like some kind of sitting room done in rich tones of red and gold, like a set from an old movie in the 30s. Expensive looking, but somehow faux, nonetheless. Dark, rich leather covered the chairs, and my feet sunk into the thick, rust-colored shag of the carpet. The velvet velour curtains had been drawn, and though the lights were all on, the place still seemed a little too dark, a little too sensual in its textures and colors. It wasn't the kind of room where you would sit and read a book. Voices came from a doorway to my right. "Wait here a minute," Murphy told me. Then she went through the door to the right of the entryway and into what I supposed was the bedroom of the suite. I wandered around the sitting room with my eyes mostly closed, noting things. Leather couch, two leather chairs, stereo and television in a black glossy entertainment center, champagne bottle warming in a stand holding a brimming tub of what had been ice the night before, with two empty glasses set beside it. There was a red rose petal on the floor, clashing with the carpeting. But then in that room, what didn't? A bit to one side, under the skirt of one of the leather recliners, was a little piece of satiny cloth. I bent at the waist and lifted the skirt with one hand, careful not to touch anything. A pair of black satin panties, a tiny triangle with lace coming off the points, lay there. One strap snapped as though the thong had simply been torn off. Kinky. The stereo system was state-of-the-art, though not an expensive brand. I took a pencil from my pocket and pushed the play button with the eraser. Gentle, sensual music filled the room. A low bass, a driving drum beat, wordless vocals, the heavy breathing of a woman as background. The music continued for a few seconds more, and then it began to skip over a section about 2 seconds long, repeating it over and over again. I grimaced. Like I said, I have this effect on machinery. It has something to do with being a wizard, with working with magical forces. The more delicate and modern the machine is, the more likely it is that something will go wrong if I get close enough to it. I can kill a copier at 50 paces. "The love suite," came the man's voice, drawing out the word love into love. "What do you think, Mr. Man?" "Hello, Detective Carmichael," I said without turning around. Carmichael's rather light, nasal voice had a distinctive quality. He was Murphy's partner and the resident skeptic, convinced that I was nothing more than a charlatan scamming the city out of its hard-earned money. "Were you saving the panties to take home yourself, or did you just overlook them?" I turned and looked at him. He was short and overweight and balding, with beady, bloodshot eyes and a weak chin. His jacket was rumpled, and there were food stains on his tie, all of which served to conceal a razor intellect. He was a sharp cop, and absolutely ruthless at tracking down killers. He walked over to the chair and looked down. "Not bad, Sherlock," he said. "But that's just foreplay. Wait till you see the main attraction. I'll have a bucket waiting for you." He turned and killed the malfunctioning CD player with a jab from the eraser end of his own pencil. I widened my eyes at him to let him know how terrified I was, then walked past him into the bedroom and regretted it. I looked, noted details mechanically, and quietly shut the door on the part of my head that had started screaming the second I entered the room. They must have died sometime the night before, as rigor mortis had already set in. They were on the bed. She was astride him, body leaned back, back bowed like a dancer. The curves of her breast made a lovely outline. He stretched out beneath her, a lean and powerfully built man, arms reaching out and grasping at the satin sheets, gathering them in his fists. Had it been an erotic photograph, it would have made a striking tableau. Except that the lovers' rib cages on the upper left side of their torsos had expanded outward through their skin, the ribs jabbing out like rabid snapped knives. Arterial blood had sprayed out of their bodies all the way to the mirror on the ceiling, along with gelatinous masses of flesh that had to be what remained of their hearts. Standing over them, I could see into the upper cavity of the bodies. I noted the now graying lining around the motionless left lungs and edges of the ribs, which apparently were forced outward and snapped by some force within. It definitely cut down on the erotic potential. The bed was in the middle of the room, giving it a subtle emphasis. The bedroom followed the decor of the sitting room. A lot of red, a lot of plush fabrics, a little over the top unless you viewed in candlelight. There were indeed candles and holders on the wall, now burned down to nubs and extinguished. I stepped closer to the bed and walked around it. The carpet squelched as I did. The little screaming part of my brain, slavishly locked up behind doors of self-control and strict training, continued gibbering. I tried to ignore it. Really, I did. But if I didn't get out of that room in a hurry, I was going to start crying like a little girl. So I took in the details fast. The woman was in her 20s, in fabulous condition. At least I thought she had been. It was hard to tell. She had hair the color of chestnuts, cut in a pageboy style, and it seemed dyed to me. Her eyes were only partly open, and I couldn't quite guess their color beyond not dark. Vaguely green. The man was probably in his 40s and had the kind of fitness that comes from a lifetime of conditioning. There was a tattoo on his right bicep, a winged dagger, that the pull of the satin sheets half concealed. There were scars on his knuckles, layers deep, and across his lower abdomen was a vicious, narrow, puckered scar that I guessed must have come from a knife wound. There were discarded clothes around, a tux for him, a little sheath of black dress and a pair of pumps for her. There were a pair of overnight bags, unopened and set neatly aside, probably by a porter. I looked up. Carmichael and Murphy were watching me in silence. I shrugged at them. "Well," Murphy demanded, "are we dealing with magic here, or aren't we?" "Either that, or it was some really incredible sex," I told her. Carmichael snorted. I laughed a little, too. And that was all the screaming part of my brain needed to slam open the doors I'd shut on it. My stomach revolted and heaved, and I lurched out of the room. Carmichael, true to his word, had set a stainless steel bucket outside the room, and I fell to my knees, throwing up. It only took me a few seconds to control myself again, but I didn't want to go back into that room. I didn't want to see what was in there anymore. I didn't want to see the two dead people, whose hearts had literally exploded out of their chests. And someone had used magic to do it. They had used magic to wreak harm on another, violating the first law. The White Council was going to go into collective apoplexy. This hadn't been an act of a malign spirit or malicious entity, or an attack of one of the many creatures of the Never-Never, like vampires or trolls. This had been the premeditated, deliberate act of a sorcerer. A wizard. A human being able to tap into the fundamental energies of creation and life itself. It was worse than murder. It was twisted, wretched perversion, as though someone had bludgeoned another person to death with a Botticelli. Turn something of beauty into an act of utter destruction. If you've never touched it, it's hard to explain. Magic is created by life, and most of all by the awareness, intelligence, and emotions of a human being. To end such a life with the same magic that was born from it was hideous, almost incestuous somehow. I sat up again and was breathing hard, shaking and tasting the bile in my mouth when Murphy came back out of the room with Carmichael. "All right, Harry," Murphy said. "Let's have it. What do you see happening here?" I took a moment to collect my thoughts before answering. They came in, they had some champagne, they danced for a while, made out, over there by the stereo, then went into the bedroom. They were there for less than an hour. It hit them when they were getting to the high point. "Less than an hour?" Carmichael said. "How do you figure?" CD was only an hour and 10 long. Figure a few minutes for dancing and drinking, and then they're in the room. Was the CD playing when they found them? "No," Murphy said. "Then it hadn't been set on a loop. I figure they wanted music just to make things perfect, given the room and all." Carmichael grunted sourly. "Nothing we haven't already figured out for ourselves," he said to Murphy. "He'd better come up with more than this." Murphy shot Carmichael a look that said, "Shut up." Then said softly, "I need more, Harry." I ran one of my hands back over my hair. "There's only two ways one could have managed this. First is by evocation. Evocation is the most direct, spectacular, and noisy form of expressed magic or sorcery. Explosions, fire, that sort of thing. But I doubt it was an evocator who did this." "Why?" Murphy demanded. I heard her pencil scritching on the notepad she always kept with her. "Because you have to be able to see or touch where you want your effect to go," I told her. "Line of sight only. The man or woman would have to have been there in the room with them. Tough to hide forensic evidence with something like that. And anyone who was skilled enough an evocator to pull off a spell like that would have had the sense to use a gun instead. It's easier." "What's the other option?" Murphy asked. "Thaumaturgy," I said. "As above, so below. Make something happen on a small scale and give it the energy to happen on a large scale." Carmichael snorted. "What bullshit." Murphy's voice sounded skeptical. "How would that work, Harry? Could it be done from somewhere else?" I nodded. "The killer would need to have something to connect them to the victims. Hair, fingernails, blood samples, that sort of thing. Like a voodoo doll?" "Exactly the same, yes." "There's fresh dye in the woman's hair," Murphy said. I nodded. "I was going to say that. Maybe if you find out where she got her hair styled, you might find something else. I don't know. Is there anything else that you can tell me that might be of use?" "Yes, the killer knew the victims, and I'm thinking it was a woman." Carmichael snorted. "I don't believe we've got to sit here and listen to this. 9 times out of 10, the killer knows the victim." "Shut up, Carmichael," Murphy said. "What makes you say that, Harry?" I stood up and rubbed my face with my hands. "The way magic works, whenever you do something with it, it comes from inside you. Wizards have to focus on what they're trying to do, visualize it, believe in it to make it work. You can't make something happen that isn't part of you inside. The killer could have murdered them both and made it look like an accident, but she did it this way. To get it done this way, she would have had to want them dead for very personal reasons. To be willing to reach inside them like that. Revenge, maybe. Maybe you're looking for a lover or a spouse. Also because of when they died, in the middle of sex. It wasn't a coincidence. Emotions are a kind of channel for magic, a path that can be used to get to you. She picked a time when they'd be together, to be charged up with lust. She got samples to use as a focus, and she planned it out in advance. You don't do that to strangers." "Crap," Carmichael said, but this time it was more of an absent-minded curse than anything directed at me. Murphy glared at me. "You keep saying she challenged me. "Why the hell do you think that?" I gestured toward the room. "Because you can't do something like that without a whole lot of hate," I said. "Women are better at hating than men. They focus it better, let it go better. Hell, witches are just plain meaner than wizards. This feels like a feminine vengeance of some kind to me." "But a man could have done it," Murphy said. "Well," I hedged. "Christ, you're a chauvinist pig, Dresden. Is it something that only a woman could have done?" "Well, no, I don't think so." "You don't think so," Carmichael drawled. "Some expert." I scowled at them both, angry. "I haven't really worked through the specifics of what I need to do to make someone's heart explode, Murph. As soon as I have occasion to, I'll be sure and let you know." "When will you be able to tell us something?" Murphy asked. I don't know, I held up a hand, forestalling her next comment. I can't put a timer on this stuff, Murph. It just can't be done. I don't even know if I can do it at all, much less how long it will take. At $50 an hour, it better not take too long, Carmichael growled. Murphy glanced at him. She didn't exactly agree with him, but she didn't exactly slap him down, either. I took the opportunity to take a few long breaths, calming myself down. I finally looked back at them. Okay, I asked them. Who are they? The victims. You don't need to know that, Carmichael snapped. Ron, Murphy asked, I could really use some coffee. Carmichael turned to her. He wasn't tall, but he was all but looming over Murphy. Oh, come on, Murph. This guy's jerking your chain. You don't really think he's going to be able to tell you anything worth hearing, do you? Murphy regarded her partner's sweaty, beady-eyed face with a sort of frosty hauteur, tough to pull off on someone 6 inches taller than she. No cream, 2 sugars. Damn it, Carmichael said. He shot me a cold glance, but didn't quite look at my eyes, then jammed his hands into his pants pockets and stalked out of the room. Murphy followed him out to the door, her feet silent, and shut it behind him. The sitting room immediately became darker, closer, with a grinning ghoul of its former chintzy intimacy dancing in the smell of blood and the memory of the two bodies in the next room. The woman's name was Jennifer Stanton. She worked for the Velvet Room.
I whistled. The Velvet Room was a high-priced escort service run by a woman named Bianca. Bianca kept a flock of beautiful, charming, and witty women, pandering them to the richest men in the area for hundreds of dollars an hour. Bianca sold the kind of female company that most men only see on television and the movies. I also knew that she was a vampress of considerable influence in the Never Never. She had power, with a capital P. I tried to explain the Never Never to Murphy before. She didn't really comprehend it, but she understood that Bianca was a badass vampress who sometimes squabbled for territory. We both knew that if one of Bianca's girls was involved, the vampress must be involved somehow, too. Murphy cut right to the point. Was this part of one of Bianca's territorial disputes? No, I said. Unless she's having it with a human sorcerer. A vampire, even a vampire sorcerer, couldn't have pulled off something like this outside the Never Never. Could she be at odds with a human sorcerer? Murphy asked me. Possible, but it doesn't sound like her. She isn't that stupid. What I didn't tell Murphy was that the White Council made sure that vampires who trifled with mortal practitioners never lived to brag about it. I don't talk to regular people about the White Council. It just isn't done. Besides, I said, if a human wanted to take a shot at Bianca by hitting one of her girls, he'd be better off to kill the girl and leave the customer healthy, to spread the tale and scare off business. Murphy said. She wasn't convinced, but she made notes of what I said. Who is the man? I asked her. Murphy looked up at me for a moment and then said evenly, Tommy, Tom. I blinked at her to let her know she hadn't revealed the mystery of the ages. Who? Tommy, Tom, she said. Johnny Marconi's bodyguard. Now it made sense. Gentleman Johnny Marconi had been the thug to emerge on top of the pile after the Bargassi family had dissolved into internal strife. The police department saw Marconi as a mixed blessing. After years of merciless struggle and bloody exchanges with the Bargassis, Gentleman Johnny tolerated no excuses in his organization, and he didn't like freelancers operating in his city. Muggers, bank robbers, and drug dealers who were not part of his organization somehow always seemed to get ratted out and turned in, or else simply went missing and weren't heard from again. Marconi was a civilizing influence on crime, and where he operated, it was more of a problem in terms of scale than ever before. An extremely shrewd businessman, he had a battery of lawyers working for him that kept him fenced in from the law behind a barricade of depositions and papers and tape recordings. The cops never said it, but sometimes it seemed like they were almost reluctant to chase him. Marconi was better than the alternative, anarchy in the underworld. I remember hearing he had an enforcer, I said. I guess he doesn't anymore. Murphy shrugged. So it would seem. So what do you do next? Run down this hairstylist angle, I guess. I'll talk to Bianca and to Marconi, but I can already tell you what they'll tell me. She flicked her notebook closed and shook her head, irritated. I watched her for a moment. She looked tired. I told her so. I am tired, she replied. Tired of being looked at like I'm some sort of nutcase. Even Carmichael, my own partner, thinks I've gone over the edge in all of this. The rest of the station thinks so, too? I asked her. Most of them just scowl and spin their index fingers around their temples when they think I'm not looking, and file my reports without ever reading them. The rest are ones who have run into something spooky out there, and they're scared shitless. They don't want to believe in anything they didn't see on Mr. Science when they were kids. How about you? Me? Murphy smiled, a curving of her lips that was a vibrantly feminine expression, making her look entirely too pretty to be such a hard ass. The world's falling apart at the seams, Harry. I guess I just think people are pretty arrogant to believe we've learned everything there is to know in the past century or so. What the hell? I can buy that we're just now starting to see things around us in the dark again. It appeals to the cynic in me. I wish everyone thought like you do, I said. It would cut down on my crank calls. She continued to smile at me, impish. But could you imagine a world where all the radio stations played ABBA? We shared a laugh. God, the room needed a laugh. Hey, Harry, Murphy said, grinning. I could see the wheels spinning in her head. Yeah? What you said about being able to figure out how the killer did this. About how you're not sure you can do it. Yeah. I know it's bullshit. Why do you lie to me about it? I stiffened. Christ, she was good. Or maybe I'm just not much of a liar. Look, Murphy, I said, there's some things you just don't do. Sometimes I don't want to get into the head of the slime I go after either. But you do what needs to be done to finish the job. I know what you mean, Harry. No, I said shortly. You don't know. And she didn't. She didn't know about my past, or the White Council, or the doom of Damocles hanging over my head. Most days, I could pretend I didn't know about it either. All the Council needed now was an excuse, just an excuse to find me guilty of violating one of the 7 laws of magic, and the doom would drop. If I started putting together a recipe for a murder spell and they found out about it, that might be all the excuse they needed. Murph, I told her, I can't try figuring this spell out. I can't go putting together the things I'd need to do it. You just don't understand. She glared at me, without looking at my eyes. I had never met anyone else who could pull that one off. Oh, I understand. I understand that I've got a killer on the loose that I can't catch in the act. I understand that you know something that can help, or you can at least find out something. And I understand that if you dry up on me now, I'm tearing your card out of the department Rolodex and tossing it in the trash. Son of a bitch. My consulting for the department paid a lot of my bills. Okay, most of my bills. I could sympathize with her, I suppose. If I was operating in the dark like she was, I'd be nervous as hell, too. Murphy didn't know anything about spells or rituals or talismans, but she knew human hatred and violence all too well. It wasn't as though I was actually going to be doing any black magic, I told myself. I was just going to be figuring out how it was done. There was a difference. I was helping the police in an investigation, nothing more. Maybe the White Council would understand that. Yeah, right. And maybe one of these days I'd go to an art museum and become well-rounded. Murphy set the hook a second later. She looked at me and my eyes for a daring second before she turned away, her face tired and honest and proud. I need to know everything you can tell me, Harry. Please. Classic lady in distress. For one of those liberated professional women, she knew exactly how to jerk my old-fashioned chains around. I gritted my teeth. Fine, I said, fine. I'll start on it tonight. Oh, boy. The White Council was going to love this one. I just have to make sure they didn't find out about it. Murphy nodded and let out a breath without looking at me. Then she said, let's get out of here, and walked towards the door. I didn't try to beat her to it. Then we walked out. The uniformed guards were still lazing around the hall outside. Carmichael was nowhere to be seen. The guys from forensics were out there, standing around impatiently, waiting for us to come out. Then they gathered up their plastic bags and tweezers and lights and things and filed past us into the room. Murphy was brushing at her windblown hair with her hand while we waited for the ancient elevator to take its sweet time about getting up to the 7th floor. She was wearing a gold watch, which reminded me. Oh, hey, I asked her, what time is it? She checked. 2:25, why? I breathed out a curse and turned for the stairs. I'm late for my appointment. I fairly flew down the stairs. I'd had a lot of practice at them, after all, and I hit the lobby at a jog. I managed to dodge a porter coming through the front with an armload of luggage and swung out into the sidewalk at a lope. I have long legs that eat up a lot of ground, and I was running into the wind, my black duster billowing out behind me. It was several blocks to my building, and after covering half of them, I slowed to a walk. I didn't want to arrive at the appointment with Monica missing man, puffing like a bellows, with my hair windblown and my face streaming with sweat. Blame it on being out of shape due to an inactive winter season, but I was breathing hard. It occupied enough of my attention that I didn't see the dark blue Cadillac until it had pulled up beside me, and a rather large man who stepped out of it into the sidewalk in front of me. He had bright red hair and a thick neck. His face looked like someone had smashed it flat with a board, repeatedly, when he was a baby, except for his jutting eyebrows. He had narrow little blue eyes that got narrower as I sized him up. I stopped and backed away, then turned around. Two more men, both of them as tall as me and a good deal heavier, were slowing down from their own jog. They had apparently been following me, and they looked annoyed. One was limping slightly, and the other wore a buzz cut that had been spiked up straight with some kind of styling gel. I felt like I was in high school again, surrounded by bullying members of the football team. "Can I help you, gentlemen?" I asked. I looked around for a cop, but they were all over at the Madison, I suppose. Everyone likes to gawk. "Get in the car," the one in front of me said. One of the others opened the rear door. "I like to walk. It's good for my heart." "You don't get in the car, it isn't going to be good for your legs," the man growled. A voice came from inside the car. "Mr. Hendricks, please, be more polite. Mr. Dresden, would you join me for a moment, please? I'd hoped to give you a lift back to your office, but your abrupt exit made it somewhat problematic. Perhaps you will allow me to convey you the rest of the way." I leaned down to look into the back seat. A man of handsome and unassuming features, dressed in casual sports jacket and Levi's, regarded me with a smile. "And you would be?" I asked him. His smile widened, and I swear it made his eyes twinkle. "My name is John Marconi, and I'd like to discuss business with you." I stared at him for a moment, and then my eyes slid aside to the very large and very overdeveloped Mr. Hendricks. The man growled under his breath, and it sounded like Cujo just before he jumped at the woman in the car. And I didn't feel like duking it out with Cujo and his two buddies. So I got into the back of the caddy with gentleman Johnny Marconi. It was turning out to be a very busy day, and I was still late for my appointment. Gentleman Johnny Marconi didn't look like the sort of man who would have my legs broken or my jaw wired shut. His salt and pepper hair was cut short. There were lines from the sun and smiling etched in the corners of his eyes. His eyes were the green of well-worn bills. He seemed to be more like a college football coach, good-looking, tanned, athletic, and enthusiastic. The impression was reinforced by the men he kept with him. Cujo Hendricks hulked like an all-pro player who'd been ousted for extreme unnecessary roughness. Cujo got in the car again, glowered at me in the rearview mirror, then pulled out into the street, driving slowly towards my office. The steering wheel looked tiny and delicate in his huge hands. I made a mental note. Do not let Cujo put his hands around my throat. Or hand. It looked like almost one of them could manage it. The radio was playing, but as I got in the car, it fouled up, squealing feedback out over the speakers. Hendricks scowled and thought about it for a second. Maybe he had to relay the message through his second brain or something. Then he reached out and fiddled with the knobs before finally turning the radio off. At this rate, I hoped the car would make it all the way to my office. "Mr. Dresden," Marconi said, smiling. "I understand you work for the police department from time to time." "They throw an occasional tidbit my way," I agreed. "Hey, Hendricks, you really should wear your seatbelt. Statistics say you're 50 or 60% safer." Cujo growled at me in the rearview mirror again, and I beamed at him. Smiling always seems to annoy people more than actually insulting them. Or maybe I just have an annoying smile. Marconi seemed somewhat put off by my attitude. Maybe I was supposed to be holding my hat in my hand, but I never really liked Francis Ford Coppola, and I didn't have a godfather. I do have a godmother, and she is inevitably, perhaps, a fairy. But that's another story. "Mr. Dresden," he said, "how much would it cost to retain your services?" That made me wary. What would someone like Marconi want me for? "My standard fee is $50 an hour plus travel expenses," I told him. "But it can vary, depending on what you need done." Marconi nodded along with my sentences, as if encouraging me to speak. He wrinkled up his face as if carefully considering what he would say, and taking my well-being into account with grandfatherly concern. How much would it set me back to have you not investigate something? You want to pay me not to do something? Let's say I pay you your standard fee. That comes out to $1,400 a day, right? $1,200, actually, I corrected him. He beamed at me. An honest man is a rare treasure. $1,200 a day. Let's say I pay you for 2 weeks' worth of work, Mr. Dresden, and you take some time off. Go catch a few movies, get some extra sleep, that sort of thing. I eyed him. And for more than $1,000 a day, you want me to... Do nothing, Mr. Dresden. Marconi smiled. Nothing at all. Just relax and put your feet up. And stay out of Detective Murphy's way. Uh-huh. Marconi didn't want me looking into Tommy Tom's murder. Interesting. I looked out the window and squinted my eyes as though thinking about it. I got all the money with me, Marconi said. Cash on the spot. I'll trust you to fulfill your end of the deal, Mr. Dresden. You come highly recommended for your honesty. I don't know, John. I'm kind of busy to be accepting any more accounts right now. The car was almost to my office building. The car door was still unlocked. I hadn't worn my seatbelt either, just in case I needed to throw the door open and jump out. See how I think ahead? That's that wizardly intellect. And paranoia. Marconi's smile faltered. His expression became earnest. Mr. Dresden, I am quite eager to establish a positive working relationship here. If it's the money, I can offer you more. Let's say double your usual fee. He steepled his hands in front of him, and he talked, half-turning towards me. My God, I keep expecting him to tell me to go out there and win one for the Gipper. He smiled at me. How does that sound? It isn't the money, John, I told him. I lazily locked my eyes onto his. I just don't think it's gonna work out. To my surprise, he didn't look away. Those who deal in magic learn to see the world in a slightly different light than everybody else. You gain a perspective you had never considered before, a way of thinking that would just never have occurred to you without exposure to the things a wizard sees and hears. When you look into someone's eyes, you see them in that other light, and for just a second, they see you in the same way. Marconi and I looked at one another. He was a soldier, a warrior behind that relaxed smile and fatherly manner. He was going to get what he wanted, and he was going to get it in the most efficient way possible. He was a dedicated man, dedicated to his goals, dedicated to his people. He never let fear affect him. He made a living on human misery and suffering, peddling in drugs and flesh and stolen goods. But he took steps to minimize that suffering because it was simply the most efficient means of running his business. He was furious over Tommy Tom's death, a cold and practical kind of fury that his rightful dominion had been invaded and challenged. He intended to find those responsible and deal with them in his own way, and he didn't want the police interfering. He had killed before, and would again. And it would all mean nothing more to him than a business transaction, than paying for groceries in the checkout line. It was a dry and cool place inside Gentleman Johnny Marcone, except for one dim corner. There, hidden away from his everyday thoughts, there lurked a secret shame. I couldn't quite see what it was, but I knew that somewhere in the past there was something that he would give anything to undo, would spill blood to erase. It was from that dark place that he drew his resolve, his strength. That was the way I saw him when I looked inside, past all his pretenses and defenses. And I was, on some instinctual level, certain that he had been aware of what I would see if I looked. That he had deliberately met my gaze, knowing what he would give away. That was his purpose in getting me alone. He wanted to take a peek at my soul. He wanted to see what sort of man I was. When I look into someone's eyes, into their soul, their innermost being, they can see mine in return. The things I had done, the things I was willing to do, the things I was capable of doing. Most people who did that got really pale, at least. One woman had passed out entirely. I didn't know what they saw when they looked in there. It wasn't a place I poked around much, myself. John Marconi wasn't like the other people who had seen my soul. He didn't even blink an eye. He just looked and assessed, and after a moment had passed, he nodded at me as though he understood something. I got the uncomfortable impression that he had duped me, that he had found out more about me than I had about him. The first thing I felt was anger, anger at being manipulated, angry that he should presume to soul gaze upon me. Just a second later, I felt scared to death of this man. I had looked on his soul, and it had been as solid and barren as a stainless steel refrigerator. It was more than unsettling. He was strong inside, savage and merciless without being cruel. He had a tiger's soul. "All right, then," he said smoothly, as though nothing had happened. "I won't try to force my offer on you, Mr. Dresden." The car was slowing down as it approached my building, and Hendricks pulled over in front of it. "Let me offer you some advice." He dropped the father to the son act and spoke in a calm and patient voice. "If you don't charge for it." Thank God for wisecracks. I was too rattled to have said anything intelligent. Marconi almost smiled. "I think you'll be happier if you come down with the flu for a few days. This business that Detective Murphy has asked you to look into doesn't need to be dragged into the light. You won't like what you see. It's on my side of the fence. Just let me deal with it, and it won't ever trouble you." "Are you threatening me?" I asked him. I didn't think he was, but I didn't want him to know that. It would have helped if my voice hadn't been shaking. "No," he said frankly, "I have too much respect for you to resort to something like that. They say you're the real thing, Mr. Dresden, the real Magus. They also say I'm nutty as a fruitcake." "I choose which they I listen to very carefully," Marconi said. "Think about what I've said, Mr. Dresden. I do not think our respective lines of work need overlap often. I would as soon not make an enemy of you over this matter." I clenched my jaw over my fear and spat words out at him quick and hard. "You don't want to make an enemy out of me, Marconi. That wouldn't be smart. That wouldn't be smart at all." He narrowed his eyes at me, lazy and relaxed. He could meet my eyes by then without fear. We had taken a measure of one another. It would not happen in such a way again. "You really should try to be more polite, Mr. Dresden," he said. "It's good for business." I didn't give him an answer to that. I didn't have one. That wouldn't sound frightened or stupidly macho. Instead, I told him, "If you ever lose your car keys, give me a call. Don't try offering me money or threats again. Thanks for the ride." He watched me, his expression never changing, as I got out of the car and shut the door. Hendricks pulled out and drove away, after giving me one last dirty look. I had soul-gazed on several people before. It wasn't the sort of thing you forgot. I had never run into someone like that, someone so cool and controlled. Even other practitioners I had met gazes with had not been that way. None of them had simply assessed me like a column of numbers and filed it away for reference in future equations. I stuck my hands in the pockets of my duster and shivered as the wind hit me. I was a wizard, throwing around real magic, I reminded myself. I was not afraid of big men and big cars. I do not get rattled by corpses blasted from life by magic more intense than anything I could manage. Really. Honest. But those dollar bill colored eyes, backed by that cool and nearly passionless soul, had me shaking as I took the stairs back up to my office. I had been stupid. He had surprised me, and the sudden intimacy of that soul gaze had startled and frightened me. All added together, it caused me to fall apart, throwing threats at him like a frightened school kid. Marconi was a predator. He practically smelled my fear. If he got to thinking I was weak, I had a feeling that polite smile and fatherly facade would vanish as thoroughly and as quickly as it had appeared. What a rotten first impression. Oh well, at least I was going to be on time for my appointment. Monica No last name was standing outside my office when I got there, writing on the back of the note I had taped to my office door. I walked toward her. She was too intent upon her writing to look up. She was a good-looking woman, in her mid-30-somethings. Ash-blonde hair that I thought must be natural, after a morbid and involuntary memory of the dead woman's dye job. Her makeup was tasteful and well applied, and her face was fair, friendly, with enough roundness of cheek to look fresh-faced and young, enough fullness of mouth to look very feminine. She was wearing a long, full skirt of palest yellow with brown riding boots, a crisp white blouse, and an expensive-looking green cardigan over it to ward off the chill of early spring. She had to be in good shape to pull off a color combination like that, and she did it. Overall, it was a naggingly familiar look, something like Annette Funicello or Barbara Billingsley, maybe. Wholesome and all-American. "Monica?" I asked. I put on my most innocent and friendly smile. She blinked at me as I approached. "Oh, are you, Harry..." I smiled and offered her my hand. "Harry Dresden, ma'am. That's me." She took my hand after a tiny pause and kept her eyes firmly focused on my chest. At this point, I was just as glad to be dealing with someone who was too nervous to risk looking at my eyes. I gave her a firm but gentle handshake and let go of her, brushing past her to unlock the office door and open it up. I apologize for being late. I got a call from the police that I had to look in on.
"You did?"
she asked.
"You mean the police,
She waved her fingers instead of finishing the sentence and entered when I held the door open for her. "Sometimes," I nodded, "they run into something and want my take on it."
"What sorts of things?"
I shrugged and swallowed. I thought of the corpses at the Madison and felt green. When I looked up at Monica, she was studying my face, chewing on her lip nervously. She hurriedly averted her gaze. "Can I get you some coffee?" I asked her. I shut the door behind us, flicked on the lights. "Oh, no, thank you, I'm fine." She stood there looking at my box of discarded paperbacks and holding her purse over her tummy with both hands. I thought she might scream if I said boo, so I made sure to move carefully and slowly, making myself a cup of instant coffee. I breathed in and out, going through the familiar motions until I had calmed from my encounter with Marconi. By the time I was done, so was my coffee. I went to my desk and invited her to have a seat in one of the two chairs across from me. "Okay, Monica," I said. "What can I do for you today?"
"Well, I told you that my husband she nodded at me, gesturing.
"Missing," I supplied.
"Yes,"
she said with an exhalation of almost relief. "But he's not mysteriously missing or anything, just gone." She flushed and stammered.
"Like he just packed up a few things and left. But he didn't say anything to anyone. And he hasn't showed up again. I'm concerned about him."
"Mm-hmm," I said. "How long has he been gone?"
"This is the third day," she said.
I nodded. "There must be some reason why you're coming to me rather than a private investigator or the police." She blushed again. She had a good face for blushing. Fair skin that colored girlishly. It was quite fetching, really.
"Yes, he had been interested in
magic?"
"Yes, he had been buying books on it in the religion section at the bookstore. Not like those Dungeon and Dragon games. The real thing. He bought some of those tarot cards."
She pronounced it like carrot. Amateurs. "And you think his disappearances might have had something to do with his interest?"
"I'm not sure," she confessed. "But maybe. He was very upset. He had lost his job and was under a lot of pressure. I'm worried about him. I thought whoever found him might need to be able to talk to him about all this stuff."
She took a deep breath, as if the effort of completing so many sentences without a single had tired her. "I'm still not clear on this. Why me? Why not the police?" Her knuckles whitened on her purse.
"He packed a bag, Mr. Dresden. I think the police will just assume he left his wife and his children. They won't really look, but he didn't. He's not that way. He only wants to make a good life for us. Really, that's all he wants."
I frowned at her, nervous that maybe hubby has run out on you after all, dear. "Even so," I said, "why come to me? Why not a private investigator? I know a reliable man if you need one."
"Because you know about..."
She gestured fitfully. "About magic," I said. Monica nodded.
"I think it might be important. I mean, I don't know, but I think it might."
"Where did he work?" I asked her. While I spoke, I got a pad of paper out of my pocket and jotted down a few notes.
"Silver Co., she told me. "They're a trading company.
They locate good markets for products and then advise companies where they can best spend their money.
Uh-huh, I said. What is his name, Monica?
She swallowed, and I saw her twitching, trying to think of something to tell me other than his name.
George, she supplied at last.
I looked up at her. She was staring furiously down at her hands.
Monica, I said.